I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have a very interesting hour here ahead of us. Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers have joined us. Bill Ayers' name, many of you know, because of what happened during the campaign with Barack Obama. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn were leaders of the Weather Underground in the 60s. Bernadine Dorn is now a professor of law. Bill Ayers, a professor of education in Chicago. We'll talk about all that and where they are and what they do and about their new book, Race Course, Against White Supremacy. And Bill and Bernadine, it's good to see you both.
Hey,
welcome,
Mark.
To
thank you. It's
thank
wonderful
you,
to be here.
It's great. I think it was just some of those things. I might have been 41 years since we last laid eyes on one another.
Let's not think about it.
and you look exactly the same.
Yeah, I wish. I remember it exactly. I was being booed off a stage at a SDS convention in 1969 when the last time I... to say we should embed ourselves among the poor and then overthrow the government as opposed to trying to overthrow it now. That was not the popular course of the day.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh.
So talk about... let's just talk, starting with the book. I really like the kind of premise that you're all working with in this book. We have something we've been talking about in the air here called the 57 percenters, which is the 57% of white Americans who voted against Barack Obama and for John McCain, and how that has kind of emblematic of very deep historic roots that are embedded in race and racism in America.
Well, the book was the result of an invitation and a provocation, really. A friend of ours who is a very famous poet and publisher of Third World Press, Haki Madhubuti in Chicago, used to be called Don Lee in the old days,
right.
And really a legend in Chicago as an institution builder and a very powerful voice for black writing. Anyway, he had this idea on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of Third World Press to ask us to write a book about why racism and the structures of white supremacy have kind of been an obsession and a passion of ours for mm-hmm. our whole political lives and social lives and professional lives. And I think because he invited us, we thought, hey, that's a great idea. And he wanted us to try to write... You know, it's not really memoir, it's not really history, it's not really sociology, but we try to use our own lives and our own life course mm-hmm. to talk about race course, to talk about the incredible, both as a seminar on racism and also as a course throughout life, you mm-hmm. know, where you can't put your finger in pretty much anywhere in the United States without... You know, the consequences, the grave consequences of slavery. So both sides of the election are worth pondering, right? Both the 43% and the 57%.
Exactly.
Because both of them are kind of surprises and mm-hmm. and not surprises.
So I wonder, and Bill, you know, when we, as I was reading through this book, I love the historical pieces. We'll talk about John Brown and some other things in a minute. But there's one quote in here I think I'll just start with just because kind of hit me was the John Hope Franklin quote that you have in the book. And it's that he observed that, quote, racial segregation, discrimination, and degradation are no unanticipated accidents in the nation's history. They stem logically and directly from the legacy that the founding fathers bestowed upon contemporary America. That really, in many ways, says a great deal about the root of who we are.
Well, exactly. And I think that one of the things we try to do in the book, Bernadine, from the perspective of a child advocate and a lawyer and somebody who's fought for justice for kids who are incarcerated and kids who are in trouble with the law, and me from the perspective of a lifelong educator, we try to foreground and understand the ways in which white supremacy still dominates the discussion in hidden, cloaked terms, but still dominates the way we look at these issues. So in education, everyone everywhere talks about the education gap, the gap between black and white in terms of testing. Very few people talk about the education debt, which is a different way of framing the same set of statistics and circumstances. That is, what is the history, the legacy of denying education first to an enslaved people, then to a segregated and oppressed people, today to an isolated and ghettoized people in some parts of our country? So what do we owe the children of formerly enslaved people? What do we owe the children of immigrants? Not how can we line them up into winners and losers on a on a scale of standardized testing. And those are the kinds of things that we try to foreground in the book.
But how do you take the thesis that you have in this book and this view of race, which is one, I think, that is talked about in some circles, but it's not a very broad discussion in America, and make it more clearly understood and make it to become part of the debate? I mean, the idea, because, you know, it's either we're in a post-racial society because Barack Obama has been elected president of the United States of America, or slavery is a part of history as a segregation. It has no effect on human consciousness, consciousness in the black community, consciousness in communities, period, in America. And there's always these disconnects we make here between them.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we make a discussion that's not dry academic, that actually talks about the roots and connect them to who we are right now?
Exactly. Well, that's what we try to do in the book,
talking
about our lives as parents, raising our kids, the questions they ask, how you explain to your children why this woman is on the street, on the sidewalk asking for money, and why, you know, the great ways in which kids, before they're suppressed and educated mm-hmm. and repressed, white kids, but all kids ask the questions, you know, about what's obviously unfair. Children, in a way, their primary question, as soon as they can talk, is that's not fair, or why is that unfair,
right.
You know. And from the playground to the family, that is, mm-hmm. you know, an urgent question. So we educate them out of it in a variety of ways, structurally and culturally in the United States, because it's not talked about and you get the code words. Or another way to see it other than through children is to see it through immigrants to the United States who immediately become somebody else. So who knew that you come to the United States as from Romania and you get a new identity as a white person?
Right.
Your identity isn't as a Romanian except in your little close circle. Or you come to the United States from the Caribbean islands and you become a black person, right? So we insist on these categories because we need them to function. They explain the world in a lot of deep ways to us. I think, you know, we've used the subtitle Against White Supremacy, but that's need some discussion because obviously white supremacy is a myth. It's not true. But it refers to things that W.E.B. Du Bois and a lot of other thinkers wrote about the structures that make the myth of white supremacy insist on it being a reality, even though it's always been contested mm-hmm. and always been resisted about. So our argument is, of course, that this is about more than prejudice and bad ideas. This is built into the very fabric of our economy, our health system, our justice system, our education system. But we try to do that through specific arguments and stories. And then the challenge and the question is, as white people, what are we supposed to do about it? We leave it to, you know, well, race is a question that comes up when there's an African-American in the room.
Exactly.
So when we're just among white people,
exactly.
Why would we talk about race? Because it's the default race. And what the hell does it mean to be white? What do we take for granted? A longer life expectancy? Yes, a longer life expectancy. So, you know, how can that be? What the heck is fair about that?
And we also have, I mean, in the world now, it's hard sometimes to focus in on the discussion because it's become more complex to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when part of the anti-war movement, part of what gave birth to the Weathermen, part of what gave birth to the Students for Democratic Society, to the feeling of revolution in the 60s was race.
Absolutely, the Black Freedom Movement.
I mean, that was the birth of it all, really.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. That's what powered it all. And the interesting thing about that, Mark, I think, is that in many ways, the original question you asked, you know, as long as we are dragging this racial legacy, as long as we're dragging this history, which is an unresolved history, as long as we drag that into the present, we're kind of victims of it. So, you know, now it's common sense to kind of say we're all equal, or the civil rights movement won. But I think there's a lot of mythology built up into that story. Before the civil rights movement began, the common sense was segregation and, you know, black criminality and this and that. The civil rights movement had to change the very way we looked at the reality before us, because before the challenge, it was taken for granted as well. So what we've got now is this myth of the 60s. We have Martin Luther King, a kind of a saint who emerged in a church in Birmingham and led a bus boycott, had a dream, gave a speech, won a Nobel, and then kind of went quietly into the night until he was assassinated. In reality, and you know this, if you read King's speeches between 65 and 68, you don't see a saintly, happy person. You see an angry pilgrim on a voyage towards justice, making the connections between racial injustice, global injustice, war, conquest, and economic injustice. And that's a very powerful joining together. And King really did that. So if you read his later speeches, you see that the agenda he was pushing, an agenda of justice and equality and fairness and economic justice and peace, was an agenda that's far from met. And we can look at all kinds of indicators. So even though we don't know what the reframing will look like, we do know that the injustice of a third of black kids being poor in this country
and growing
and that
instead
will
of diminishing
that's right, and that will be close to 50% if the economic conditions continue. Kids going to schools in a city like Chicago, which are dilapidated, falling down, backward, overcrowded, and that reality based on the hierarchy of race. So these are things that we have to amplify, magnify, foreground, challenge. And what will lead to the next upheaval, I don't know. But I'm certain that that imbalance cannot hold. And talking about it openly, honestly, revisiting the history in a serious way is part of our task now.
Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn are both in the studio. They've written a book together, Race Course, Against White Supremacy. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn were both founders of the Weathermen. Bill Ayers, of course, rose to public attention because of the around the campaign of Barack Obama. But now Bill Ayers is Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And Bernadine Dorn is a Director of the Children and Family Justice Center and Clinical Associate Professor at Northwestern School of Law.
Ironies, Mark.
There are ironies. I was thinking about that. You know, that little diversion here, come right back to the book and race. Is that you have kind of rebuilt your lives after in a way that it can be almost unexpected.
Well, everybody
we all have, I think,
from the quote 60s, you know, generation has indeed. That's right. And everybody who survived the 60s has you have to live in the next generation and the next generation. The 60s, of course, is largely a myth anyway. And, and you know, there's been a long, consistent thread of struggle and resistance in the United States. And when you give it a decade name, you're in danger. And we often push back against the 60s blanket because there's so many young organizers and activists today. And for many of them, instead of the 60s being an interesting inspiration, it's a wet blanket. And we're stuck with some metaphors that we can't get out of. So I think we want to, you know, on the one hand, we feel obviously lucky to have been born into that moment in time and to really be part of a group that thought we could change the world. We're willing to leave behind a lot of options and you know, strike out to really make a revolution. On the other hand, I think we don't want to – we were never that good and we were never that bad, I guess is what I'd say. And people today, young people today, have to, you know, name the moment, analyze the world that we're in and make new strategies and not measure them against something that is not going to happen that way again.
So I want to, in the context of history, and a lot of your book is history. I mean, American history, the history of race in America, John Brown and the rest, which I think we should get into now. I mean, it's – but in the context of what you were just talking about, Bernadine, I mean, in the 1960s, I mean, to be very clear, we have on the show many times that there are many of us at that point who actually thought – there was going to be a revolution in America.
Absolutely.
There's something, and it was a time when the federal government was deeply involved, not just in annihilating the Vietnamese people, but in killing black and Native American leaders, especially in America. They met John Trudell, and he lost his wife to kind of a FBI goon squad thing, killing his wife and children in Nevada, or Fred Hampton in Chicago, and many other examples we can talk about. There's still people in jail from that time.
Right.
And in the context of that, clearly there were things that we had wrong. We weren't going to overthrow a government. But there was a fervor and an anger about what was happening that grabbed a young population then.
Mm-hmm.
And put that in the context of where we are now, and also for us, put that in the context of this wonderful chapter in this book about John Brown, who was a revolutionary, also left his family and to kind of fight violently to end slavery in America.
Right. So, well, let's hold John Brown for a minute and stay with the 60s question. Do you want to talk about it?
Well, I would say that, you know, the myth making of the 60s, which we talked about, obviously there's inspirational and aspirational hopes that we can look at and find some guidance from. But I think that no generation has a corner on the market of courage and risk and dreaming big. No decade has a monopoly on chaos, catastrophe, and confusion. So the kind of holding up of the 60s, in many ways, it's kind of a Rorschach test for how people want to live their lives today. They look at the 60s and say it was hell or it was heaven, and neither is true. The fact is that we really have felt not that we lived in the 60s and now we're reinvented today. We have felt the consistency in our own lives, and the consistency is that we were both fortunate to come awake and come alive in the cauldron of the Black Freedom Movement, to find our bearings in opposition to nuclear arms and to war and conquest by our own government, and then to try to carve out a life where we were living in a way that we didn't make a mockery of our values. That's been what we've tried to do. Different times, of course, require different answers to that question. We've raised 3 kids. We have a couple of grandkids now. We've worked
took care of our parents. Our parents lived with us for 8 years. And, you know, I think that –
can I interrupt you?
I just want to stay with your point, because indeed we did think it was a revolutionary moment.
We did.
Many of us, you among them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was reasons why we did. We weren't just foolish idealists, mm-hmm. you know. We had a global – we looked at the world around. We challenged the idea of American exceptionalism. Revolutions can happen everywhere else but never here. We recognized that the United States was pieced together from conquest, as you say, and that, you know, a large part of it belonged to Mexico, a large part of it belonged to the Pacific Islanders, and so mm-hmm. on. And that, you know, the labor of black enslaved people had created, you know, the wealth of the country. And I think from that perspective, we thought, who knows, you know, how it will come apart. Now we have a different – so I think we weren't wrong. One of the interesting things about looking back and looking and grappling with what we have today is that you don't know in your own lifetime how it's going to turn out. You can only act in your moment. And I think this is an important kind of idea for young people today. You can – you know, during the period of the abolitionist movement and the anti-slavery movement, nobody knew how it was going to turn out. If you decided to be part of the Underground Railroad, if you were alive then and you decided as a Southerner you were going to teach enslaved people to read or provide resources for them to escape, or if you were a Northerner on the Underground Railroad, think of it. Now it looks like, oh, of course, if I were alive then that's who I'd be. But you had to break the law.
Mm-hmm.
You broke – your church was against it, except for maybe the Quakers. Your parents were against it. Your children were at risk of being killed. Not just you. Your children
right.
were at risk
right.
of being killed. And so the reasons not to do it were enormous. You had to be a little obsessed and crazy to do it because you were risking everything. So you had to see it as an absolutely fundamental human right that defined your own humanity as well as other people's humanity. And it turns out damn few people did that. And it's interesting. So if you don't act in history with partial knowledge, who knew that the Underground Railroad would be a precondition, in a way, for John Brown, and a precondition for the Civil War, and a precondition for Black Reconstruction, and so on. We didn't know that looking forward, and the same is true today. Our children, our grandchildren going to say to us, you mean, you know, 140 million, 50 million citizens, people, human beings were in the United States denied citizenship, even though they were paying taxes and contributing to the wealth and the well-being of the country, and almost every middle-class person relied directly on their labor to take care of their kids and to take care of their house and to take care of their buildings that they worked in, and they were denied, you know, the benefits of being in that society. Oh, yeah, you mean 2.4 million people were imprisoned, and they were overwhelmingly African-American and Latino young men, and mainly for nonviolent offenses, and they were in these dungeons, and there were gulags within 20 miles of wherever you were in the United States, and what did you do? So I can hear our granddaughter saying this, you know, and you think, holy cow, how do you live in your moment and be a moral person and not be overwhelmed by the challenge but take on a piece of it?
That what you just said is very powerful, Bernadine. I think it is part of what, to me, is the dialogue across generations that has to take place, that you two are very much trying to do, I think, is to figure out what you do in your moment. Because if you look at the course of American history, it's been those who stood up and kind of were prepared to take the worst punishment to change things is what keeps pushing this country forward. I mean, that's... You know, and if you think about it, and I made a mistake by saying reinventing your lives. You didn't reinvent your lives because we're all part of this continuum. And we just keep pushing and moving. That was just something that came out of some stupid establishment media thing that was in my head.
But you've been doing it too. I mean, that's what's so interesting. You know, here you are.
And
so truth-telling in a time of denial.
And you have to do that. So so what does that take us now? Because one of the things people always ask you, well, you were a terrorist in the 1960s and you blew up buildings and, you know, so you're just like Al-Qaeda and all that kind of madness is also part of the conversation that follows the two of you wherever you go. And put that in the context for today's young people, I think, is really important.
Yeah. Well, I think that... Burton said it a minute ago. I think that today's young people suffer under a kind of illusion or myth-making about the 60s. And I think too many folks of our generation are kind of nostalgic for a ship that already left the shore.
Yep.
I want to live looking forward. So whatever we did in the 60s, and some of it was magnificent and some of it was quite foolish, but whatever we did, it was prelude for what lies ahead. And the challenges facing us today, and frankly, when I say us, I'm a person of this generation. In fact, I could pull out my SDS card, membership card. And one of the things I love about the preamble to the SDS, to the Port Huron Statement, which is on our membership card, it says, we are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, looking uneasily at the world we inherit. I'm still that person. I'm still of this generation.
Right.
I'm still looking uneasily at the world we inherit, and I intend to do something about it. So I think that Bernie and I have been involved in many, many political movements, many social movements. Right now, we're very excitedly involved in a movement making, a movement building process in Chicago, and it has a bunch of different kind of thrusts. One is we're trying to develop a dialogue in Chicago across the various projects and issues that we care about. So you can't disconnect war from warming. You can't really disconnect the demonization and scapegoating of gay people from the kind of repressive policies of the government and so on. So these are things that we're trying to create forums where we can come together and learn to dialogue, really listen with the possibility of being changed, really speak with the possibility of being heard. We're trying in that process to say, look, those of us who are progressive are not a minority, and we have to stop thinking like a minority. It's astonishing to me that Obama cleans the clock of the Republican right, and they still are the noisiest people in town, still thinking like they represent everybody. The fact is, on issue after issue after issue, we represent, I think, a majority view, and we have to start thinking that way. We have to change the frame of how we discuss issues. Bernadine mentioned imprisonment. If we think we're safe because we're incarcerating more and more people. That's a myth, and that's a fool's errand. If we think we're safe as a country because we invade other countries and have 150 military bases around the world, that's something that's going to endanger us. So we're involved in this process right now of movement building, of trying to really create the conditions where we can make a powerful difference in this moment of yes, we can.
Right, and people who are interested could look it up on the web. It's a movement, Reimagining Change, ARC 109, because our idea was 2 years ago, the hope for change, right? But for what, mm-hmm. right? Where are we going with this? And yes, I can, what? And right. So we were looking to 109 to say, okay, what are we going to do now? And I just want to take one example from what Bill just said which is a majority of the American people, by the polling, are against this escalation in Afghanistan and the bombing of Pakistan by the United States. Already just happened, and they're against it. Now, are we going to build an anti-war movement on that, or are we going to rest on the fact that a majority are against it? I think we have a huge job here to do, which is to a lot of the things we did with Vietnam, but new things, support these. I spoke last weekend with a young woman who's an Afghan vet against the war. I mean, these kids coming back have huge needs. They've seen the horrors of war, and they can really describe what's going on. We need to humanize the Afghan and Pakistani people. We need to teach, we need teach-ins about who they are and what they are, because the images we get, the rest of the world sees, a whole different kind of array of media than what we get here. So, and we really have to talk about what makes us safe. We have to, bite into the fear that we need this. This is somehow going to make us safer. So I think we just have a huge job to do to take what is already a resistance to war and expansion of war and make it concrete. Of course, 57% of the budget, the U.S. budget, going to the military. That already freaks people out, and when the bottom is falling out of the economy here.
And isn't it? I mean, a growing majority of people are for single payer. I mean, you see that.
That's right.
It's a groundswell that people haven't been able to figure out how to get a hold of.
But you're exactly right, and issue after issue. But let's remember that Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation in history, was not part of the Black Freedom Movement.
No.
FDR wasn't part of the labor movement. Lincoln was never a member of an abolitionist party. Something else is going on, and that's why for us, we continue to return to the idea of building an independent of the Democratic Party, independent of any kind of party apparatus, an independent, interconnected, multi-issue movement for peace and justice. And with that kind of movement, I know that we can have an impact on the future. But without that kind of movement, and it will look different than anything we've seen before, but we have to put the groundwork in now to learn to talk to each other, to learn to act on behalf of whatever the known demands, and to get moving. So that's what we're doing in Chicago, and we're very, very hopeful about it.
I mean, it's just like Barack Obama said when he was asked who would Martin Luther King back in this election, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, he said neither one of us, he'd be out on the streets organizing a movement for social change.
Exactly. That was our favorite moment of the whole campaign. And only a community organizer,
right.
Someone who had been a community right. organizer, would say that. So I think we really do have, if we don't build a radical independent movement, we're seeding the ground to the right wing and to the militarists and the people who thinks our kids should have more guns and weapons in their hands. It's crazy.
But
so of course we should build a radical movement.
And I think you nailed, it's interesting because we often quote that response because it means a lot to us and it is our favorite moment. And it tells us that this is a guy who understands that while clearly he exercises power at the top, he also recognizes, and we should recognize and build the fact that power exists at the bottom, and it's up to us to mobilize and build that power.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We'll be back to finish our conversation with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn right after this short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. And we'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back to our conversation with Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. Before we run out of time, there are two things I do want to raise with you, one from the book and one not necessarily from the book. And the one from the book is that we were talking about walking up to the studio, Bernadine, which was John Brown.
Right.
And there's a chapter in here that revolves around John Brown.
Right. Right.
And the 105th anniversary is now. So,
Well, we were just at the John Brown Farmhouse in North Elba last weekend.
Oh, really?
And it was John Brown's birthday, 209th birthday on May 5th.
As Bill's putting on a John Brown button.
Right. And our chapter begins with me wearing that button, walking into a coffee mm-hmm. shop, Bill and I walking into this coffee shop, and the barista girl saying to me, "Oh, I love Walt Whitman." And me saying, "I do too, but this is John Brown," and her face goes completely blank, you know, because who knows about John Brown?
Right, right.
And so we were up there to celebrate his birthday. It was a beautiful rainy day up in the Adirondacks there, where he's buried. But, of course, you were right. This is the 150th anniversary this fall of the raid on Harper's Ferry and then his trial and execution and a funeral cortege that went back up to North Elba where he and his sons are buried. So we wrote the chapter really trying to explain and think about why we were so fixed on John Brown when we discovered who he was in the 60s. And I guess you were too if you were in mm-hmm. the John Brown Collective.
Yes, I was.
So
in Waverly here in Baltimore.
So why did we find this white guy who was extremely religious and a failed businessman and willing to sacrifice his children and so on? You know, he had a single-minded and deep and abiding uneasiness, unable to live his life because other people were in bondage. And his identification with the suffering of people who were enslaved was total and consuming. And so he was part of the Underground Railroad up at North Elba. Then he took his sons and went and fought in Kansas, which was a fight over whether Kansas would be
slave
or free. And mm-hmm. it was a bloody fight. It was bloody Kansas. And then he spent 2 years traveling, actually went to Europe, borrowed money and went to Europe, but traveling around the country, meeting with the African-American leaders of the day, went to Canada, met with a huge Congress, open Congress there of free black citizens in Canada, raising money and talking about his military strategy to fight for the freedom of the people who were enslaved in the South. And so it's just a fascinating history. And I remember, I'm sure you remember, seeing a picture of him in our history books, you know, as a beady-eyed fanatic.
Right, exactly. Right? That's who he was in our history books. He was a beady-eyed fanatic.
Yeah,
right.
As Jim Lowen said in Lies My Teacher Told Me, he said that John Brown was officially insane from 1890 to 1970.
I love that. That's.
So, you know, looking at him, why does W.E.B. Du Bois, maybe the greatest social historian ever to come out of American history, why does he write a whole book about John Brown? You know, very interesting, right? And why does Frederick Douglass, who met with Brown regularly, knew of his military plan, didn't join it, helped finance it, give an oration how many years later, 1871, about the trial and execution of John Brown. And, you know, Whitman and Thoreau and the Boston abolitionists agonizing about what they did and didn't do, but standing up right at the moment of his capture and trial and building a solidarity movement.
And Thoreau writing that brilliant essay, Captain John Brown, in which he defends Brown. So here's the hero of civil disobedience, you know, right out there saying that this was very important and a right thing to do.
So I wonder and I have wrestled with this, and I'm just curious, really, I get your response to this. Given that, and again, we're talking with Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers about their latest book, Race Course, Against White Supremacy. They're traveling through Baltimore, and they came to our studios. They're doing many things down here while they're here. Is that when you look at what John Brown did, and he stood up armed and to try to overthrow slavery and end it, create a rebellion, you look at what some did in the 60s, which was kind of the stand up. You all, for your a lot of different reasons, myriad reasons, other old friends of mine like Mark Rudd and all of you just went underground and created the Weather Underground. And there were some of us here who saw ourselves as the above-ground allies of the underground at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at young people and people who are in their 20s and 30s now who are active in trying to change the course of things and push things forward, and people still are battling over, do you fight police in the street? Do you pick up a gun and fight? Do you what role do you play in trying to build a different America and a different world? When you reflect on the lives that you all led, that we all led in our 20s and 30s, and what do you say to people in our 20s and 30s right now about that?
Don't confuse tactics with your organizing strategy. Tactics change all the time, but they're not at the core of your of the content of what you're working on. And Bill has a very good way of saying that the test is who you educated. The test of any action, a demonstration, a leaflet, a teach-in, a theater production, a musical event, a comedy show. I mean, who knows what opens people's eyes? I think during the bleak years of the Bush administration, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Aaron Magruder, you know, kept us all able to go to sleep at night because of their poking fun at the, you know, at the powers that be.
Yeah, I think that that's a good way of putting it. The standard is not a tactical standard. The standard is an organizer standard. If you're trying to educate people, which we must do if we want a real social movement, then the standard by which we look at our behavior and our actions and our interventions is not a performance standard. How did I look? How did I feel? Was I really wonderful and self-righteous? It's an educational standard. Did I teach? Did I learn? And the problem with that is you can't know it a priori. You can only know it. You can use that as a good standard to reflect and evaluate. But sometimes Bobby, you know, you think of Bobby Sands in a British prison, you know, starving himself to death.
The Irish Republican Army.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, that was a tactic that I don't recommend to people. But in that context, for Bobby Sands, killing himself in front of the world was an extraordinarily educational moment. So we don't know. I mean, John Brown, every Union soldier went into battle singing John Brown's
That's
Body.
Right.
So did he know that at the moment of his death? No. Read his last statements. He was in pretty much despair about what was going to happen. And yet he was an iconic figure for the North and then demonized again after the defeat of Reconstruction and made into a cartoon character of mindless fanaticism.
Or take a look at the, you know, the Quilt Project and the fight to educate people about AIDS in the United States.
Who knew?
Or,
right.
I mean, you can go on and on. The Republic workers in Republican and windows and doors workers in Chicago in December, right, or November, right after the election, who were told by the people who owned their plant, they'd been working there for 17 years, they were told that the plant was shutting down and moving to a non-union state, right, Missouri. And they weren't going to get their benefits, their earned time,
right,
their vacation leave and sick leave and so on. And they sat in, group of workers there, supported by the UE, the United Electrical Workers, and a huge group of people, Jobs with Justice, our friend James Tinwin, Chicago, and so on, surrounded the factory and, you know, broadcast their demands out to the world. And, of course, Bank of America was at the key here of this move and the refinancing and so on. And they were able to, like, put together the whole picture and win within 2 weeks by sitting in.
But that doesn't mean that the tactic is sitting in.
No,
nor
it doesn't.
Does Stonewall
exactly.
mean, nor does Stonewall mean that the tactic is a riot, nor does John Brown mean that the tactic is seizing an armory. The tactics change, but what remains the same is the willingness, the courage to open your eyes, to see the world as it is, to be fearless in taking that on, and then to doubt and reconsider and rethink, given this, you know, this pedagogical standard. That's what we recommend.
So let me, in the few minutes we have left, I want to come back to the substance of the book here and talk about something again from the 60s, but bring it to the modern, to bring it to where we are now in the century. In the 1960s, and Bernadine, I know you were close to this group on a number of levels, and I was very close to this group on a number of levels, was you joined in Uptown Chicago and mm-hmm. the Young Patriots and the paper about the Fine Line, and they were known as the Hillbilly Black Panthers because they were all from Appalachia in the South, and they were young working-class white kids who were revolutionaries. And I worked with them on the Poor People's Campaign. We organized the South for the Poor People's Campaign together, Doug Youngblood and others, and I did that together in the South. And so when you think about where we started with the 57 percenters who voted for McCain and the 43% of white Americans who voted for Barack Obama, and these young people back in that period in Peggy Terry and those people who came out of a very racist environment but flipped in terms of where their alliances were, it was a very interesting moment. So much really do more about that time because they're very emblematic. Talk about that in terms of where we're going in race in America.
I think that's a you know, it's fun talking to you, Mark, because we share a lot of assumptions in history here. And I think, I went as a young law student in Chicago and really quite an apolitical, naive, you know, Midwestern girl from the west side of Chicago, where I was smart enough to leap in with Dr. King when he came to Chicago and kind of hurl myself into that struggle, and then got recruited by the people and I'm working in Uptown. And I was able to see in a short 2-year window, the really wretched conditions of segregation and dispossession on the west side, and then the same kind of conditions but with white people mm-hmm. who migrated from Kentucky and Appalachia, West Virginia. And I think this campaign, the Obama campaign, has reopened that window in a dramatic way, two ways. One is a lot of young people and old people found themselves becoming community organizers again. So he was able to galvanize a participatory electoral campaign instead of only a money. He also was able to galvanize a money-driven electoral campaign. But it wasn't just that. And it's the participatory part that I think is interesting. People did knock on doors, did listen to people say unbelievable racist things, and yet be open to talking about the issues. And I think that white people especially, but sometimes Latino people and Arab American people, and you know, you're suddenly in the reality of all of the conflicts in U.S. life. And I think that that task that Ella Baker was so great about in the South, she was one of the people who nurtured the founding of SNCC, of the Southern Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And her idea was, you know, you take students and you put them with sharecroppers in the South, not because the students are just going to bring answers. Of course, you should have the right to vote. Of course, you should stand up. But because the students themselves will be changed by listening to the wisdom and the understanding of the people who have the problems. And it is in that listening as well as in that talking that you have a transformation of both parties, that you have the possibility of figuring out ways to stand up. And sometimes those ways are, you know, carry with them a high price. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a new network organization called Ella's Daughters, by the way, for young women that you can also find online that we're working with. And I think that's what's exciting to me about this moment is that a lot of people, by working in the campaign or, you know, working in the issues for health and education and economic justice and living wage and green, saving the planet and sustainability, have found themselves talking to people with whom we profoundly disagree on mm-hmm. some issues. People who hate gay people and think that they should be driven from the land. People who are racists and can't imagine voting for a black guy, even when their interests lie with them. And it is in that conversation that we're going to both learn and move people. And I just feel like we should not get carried away and not still savor the fact. We wake up every day thinking, holy cow, you know, the Obama family is in the White House. Who could have imagined? So at the same time as we don't think he's a king and we don't think we should just criticize him or wait for him to save us, either one, it's up to us to build a movement to save him, really. But I think so we want to savor that moment and realize that a lot of people, as well as the 57%, the 43%, a good half of those people couldn't have imagined voting for him a year before. And so that's the transformation we have to work about.
It shows the depth and the tenuousness of it all.
That's exactly right.
In one breath.
Exactly.
I think that we are probably running out of time here. I know you've got to run, it's been a real pleasure to see you both again.
Hey, let's do it more. Wait 40 years.
Let's not wait 40 years. 40 years, my God. If we'll be here in 40 years, I'm not sure. But Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers were in the studio. Their book is Race Course Against White Supremacy. It's a book, I think, that if you have a little book club out there, get this book and argue this book in your book club. It would be a good idea. Race Course Against White Supremacy, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn. And pleasure to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Take care. I want to let you all know about a great event coming up that I hope you'll be part of. On Wednesday, May 27th, please join me at 6 p.m. for a live broadcast of The Mark Steiner Show from the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University. I'll be interviewing Bob Luke, author of the new book from Johns Hopkins University Press, The Baltimore Elite Giants. Joining us on stage will be Bert Simmons, who is a pitcher on that team in the Negro Baseball Leagues. This live broadcast will be followed by a book signing and a reception. I hope you join us for this event, which is free and open to the public. Please visit steinershow.org or call 410-516-4162 for more information. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. On this day in our history, May 26th, so much occurred, so seemingly disconnected but tied together by the string of resistance to tyranny, by tyranny's ugly hand, by forces of peace seeking a voice to open the doors of oppression and repression and to open the hearts and minds of their fellow citizens and human beings. Sometimes in ways that baffled us, inspired us, and shook our core as run-of-the-mill beings. On this day in 1799, the great Russian writer, born of nobility, who fought for democratic Russia and justice, Alexander Pushkin was born. On this day in 1938, the dreaded House Committee on Un-American Activities was formed, a committee looking for subversives and communists under everyone's bedsheets and in everyone's closets that ruined thousands of innocent lives. And on this day in 1966, a Buddhist nun, Thich Nhat Hanh Quang, immolated herself in the city of Hue, Vietnam, saying, "By the grace of being aware of my becoming, I go." She inspired tens of thousands of Vietnamese to take to the streets, demanding an end to that war, to the violence and the destruction of their people and their nation. President Johnson said it was unnecessary to do, but he didn't understand the power of sacrifice and the determination of the Vietnamese people. Their deep belief, the Buddhist deep belief in nonviolence, was mirrored in America by civil rights activists in the 1960s. On May 4th, 1961, the legendary Congress of Racial Equality, known as CORE, Director James Farmer, led the Freedom Riders out of Washington, D.C., to challenge racial segregation at bus stations across the South. They were confronted by angry mobs and jailed on the way. In Anniston, Alabama, a mob set upon them in a Greyhound bus carrying 7 black and 6 white Freedom Riders. They firebombed the bus, tried to keep the door shut to burn the Freedom Riders alive. The engine exploded, forcing the mob to retreat. But when the Freedom Riders left the burning bus, the mob attacked, severely beating and almost killing some of the Freedom Riders. Then Freedom Rides began pouring throughout the South in nonviolent defiance of segregation and defying the violent segregationists intent on killing and maiming those who would dare to challenge the unnatural order of oppression against black people. They rode protesting in Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and winding up in New Orleans. In Birmingham, Alabama, the Ku Klux Klan and the police set upon the Freedom Riders with baseball bats and iron pipes. The local police let the beatings go on. A Justice Department official lay unconscious on the ground, as did Freedom Rider Jim Swag. White Freedom Riders were singled out for the worst beatings. Jim Peck received 52 stitches in his head, and they wouldn't let the ambulances come through to take the beaten to the hospitals. The black community came to their rescue. President John F. Kennedy and his administration wanted the Freedom Riders to take a cooling-off period to stop pushing for freedom in the wake of the violence that was tearing at the fabric of this nation. But many, like Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, now known as SNCC, leader Diane Nash, would have none of it. The fabric had to be torn asunder in order for it to be whole again. She said we must keep up the momentum. Then Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy said that he, quote, does not feel that the Department of Justice can side with one group or the other in disputes over constitutional rights, end quote. So on this day in 1961, the Freedom Riders Coordinating Committee was formed in Atlanta, Georgia, in defiance of the Kennedy administration's call for a cooling-off period. Reverend Martin Luther King spoke, James Farmer spoke, among many, many others, and CORE, SNCC, and King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, known as SCLC, launched more Freedom Rides throughout the South. The Freedom Rides, the power of nonviolent resistance, the tenacity and righteousness of their cause, caught the heart and soul of this nation. The Kennedy administration was forced to back down in the face of the riders' credibility. They ordered a reluctant Interstate Commerce Commission, known as the ICC, to implement policies ending segregated seating on interstate buses and ending separate waiting rooms, separate bathrooms, separate restaurants, and white-only drinking fountains at Greyhound and Trailway bus stations throughout the South. It launched a civil rights movement throughout this nation that eventually ended segregation and led to the Civil Rights Bill of 1965. The bravery and the power of the few, of nonviolent warriors for human rights and justice, has changed this nation forever. And that's what happened in history on this day of May 26th. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite delves into hidden phenomena, shadowy characters, undisclosed locations, and other mysteries of Baltimore. It's the Secrets Issue, available now at over 800 locations around the region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman, and at Clean Cuts Music and Sound by Andrew Epic. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.